If you like listening to my conversations with interesting people, you'll love listening to them or watching them on Nebula, the creator-owned streaming service where you can get access to these interviews early and ad-free, as well as bonus episodes from my YouTube channel and exclusive series you can't find anywhere else. Sign up for Nebula by clicking the link in the description or go to nebula.tv/conversationswithjoe to support the podcast and help promote content that matters.
I'd say I'm an instrumentalist. I don't actually believe that nature is mathematics, though a lot of theoretical physicists, at least the ones that I know, believe that. I would just say it describes reality, and it does that suspiciously well, you know, as Wigner put it in his essay about the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics and the natural sciences. And that's still somewhat of a mystery. Like, why does it work so well?
Sabina Hassenfelder is a science communicator on YouTube, just like me, but very much not like me. She is an actual honest-to-God theoretical physicist with a PhD in physics, and she's published over 80 papers in science journals covering everything from quantum gravity to particle physics, cosmology, astrophysics, statistical mechanics, and quantum foundations. All of which is to say that if you hear her contradict something that I've said, listen to her. She's an actual expert on this stuff. She also recently published a new book, Existential Physics, A Scientist's Guide to Life's Biggest Questions, which sounds right up my alley, kind of stuff I cover on my channel. So I wanted to get her on here to talk about being a science communicator from the perspective of an actual scientist. And from there, it went to all kinds of places, as you might expect, but I'll let you hear that for yourself. I just wanted to say thanks to Sabina for taking the time for me. Really enjoy getting to meet her, so why don't we just jump into it? Here's my conversation with Sabina Hassenfelder. I've always wanted to ask, your channel says science without the gobbledygook. What exactly is gobbledygook in your mind?
Gobbledygook, fancy sounding blah blah. Oh, okay. I took this word from a quote which is actually in the beginning of my new book, from what's his name, Nicholas Kristof, the guy who writes for the New York Times. That scientists phrase their insights in terms of gobbledygook and then hide it in obscure journals where no one can read it. So this is where I took it from. Originally, I wanted to call it science without the spin.
Oh, okay.
And then I realized, okay, people are going to misunderstand it. Because spin and physics, means something else. And so I was looking for a replacement for spin, and that's what sprang to mind.
So it's science without the angular momentum.
Exactly. That's what I'm afraid that
which,
understand.
Which sounds more like gobbledygook, actually. So was that kind of your original motivation for like, I mean, obviously you've been writing books and articles and stuff for a long time, but when you say like science without the spin, it kind of sounds like you wanted to counter some let's say bad communication in science that's been going on. Is that accurate?
Yeah, so originally I set up this channel to talk about my own research. So I was talking about dark matter and quantum gravity phenomenology and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But over the years, I've been doing a lot of freelance writing for quite a variety of outlets. You know, you have to write a pitch and you send it to the editor and the editor says either yay or nay. And I found this a very frustrating experience because a lot of times the stuff that I thought was interesting or that just had to be said didn't go past the editor's desk. They were like, no, it's not timely enough, it's not interesting enough, people aren't going to read it, you know, it's not going to sell, basically. That's the major problem. And so I thought, well, then I'm just going to be my own editor. Mm-hmm. And so over the course of time, my channel drifted into this more general scientific newsy stuff, like what's going on, what's the stuff that you actually need to know. Mm-hmm. And as you've probably noticed, a lot of the stuff that I talk about is fairly general background stuff. Is not the kind of stuff that you would get published in your typical newspaper, magazine, or so on. It's just too boring in a certain sense, you know. And I stand by it. I'm like, you know, I'll feed you all the numbers and the data and the facts.
Also, like, so you're talking about sort of more mainstream editors that were kind of turning stuff down because I guess it was too nerdy or whatever. but not so much like the scientific journals. That's obviously a different thing.
Oh yeah, I was talking about popular science stuff.
Gotcha. Okay. I'll always have to ask people like you when I have on here that are actual experts in these things, because I am not. I kind of just fell backwards into science communication because I just had a little bit of a nerdy streak to me, and I started doing, comedy videos, and it was like, hey, let's talk about science stuff, and it, wound up working. But I'm not an actual scientist remotely, and yet I talk about this stuff, and I'm always really self-conscious about, like, oh, am I doing this right? Am I saying the right things? And I always want to ask people who come on here who are actual, scientists and PhDs and stuff. It's like, am I okay doing this? Is
You're
this okay that I'm doing
you're
it?
doing a very good job. Actually, I think there's,
Well.
it's probably easier if you come from it that way. So in my case, it was exactly the opposite. I started from science communication and fell backwards into comedy stuff, which is far worse. But no, you're doing a pretty good job. And one of the biggest problems that I see with people who have a science background, they've made a master's degree or they've made a PhD and they did some research and then they went into science writing, is that they have a hard time communicating with normal people. Let me put it
Sure,
this way. It just becomes too technical. They have gotten so used to all those technical terms that they don't really understand how much effort it takes to keep track of it. And that's a trap which you don't fall into. And I think it's one of the reasons that people like your channel. It's like you actually get it across what you want to say.
Well, I've made the argument many times that if I can get myself to understand a topic, then I can get somebody else to understand it, because I'm not an expert on that kind of thing. So if I pat myself on the back for anything, I guess it's that. But I always still worry that, like, the last thing that I want to do is put more misinformation into the world, and get something wrong. I would sort of, I don't know, calm myself down by being like, you know what, you're just kind of getting people interested in the subject, and then they can go and look into it further. And if you get something wrong, then they'll find that out later on or something like that. But I still don't like the idea of getting things wrong, and I get a little self-conscious about it. But
Oh, well, I have exactly the same problem. It's like my nightmare. One of those days I'm going to get something important really, really wrong. And so far it's been some minor things. But yeah, I lose sleep over this.
That means we're good people, right?
Well, that's what I like to think.
Because we don't want to, contribute to
Yeah, but I mean, I also have to say like that YouTube is like, it makes it pretty hard to get things right because you can't correct it. Like if you
that.
write and you put it online, you can just change it and then put a correction at the bottom. But in YouTube, it's like you either take it down or you stick with it.
I miss the annotations. They used to have that. You could put a little like box up on screen to say, like, oh, I was wrong here or something. You can correct yourself. You can't do that anymore.
Exactly. I've been, leaving comments on the creator channel about this for a couple of months, saying that I want them back. I want them back because it's so frustrating, if I get something wrong, and there'll be 1,000 people pointing out, it was something like recently I said microsecond when I should have said millisecond or something. And then you put it in the info below the video, but of course no one looks there. So I have to reply to all the comments saying, I'm so sorry I got this wrong. Yes, you're completely right. It should have been millisecond. I'm so dumb, blah, 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 blah. And then I'm like, if I could just put the thing directly on the video saying, should have been millisecond. I'm so sorry. It would just make things easier.
Sometimes when you're lucky, you can catch it before it goes out, and you can put a little text on screen in the editing, but it's usually way after. And this, isn't that like the worst? Because I have a video that just came out today. It's always the worst feeling when you like go into the comments, and like the very first like three comments are like correcting you on something you got wrong. It's just like, oh God, seriously? Because it's just like that creeping sense of like, do I need to take this down? Is it that bad? But I usually don't.
Trust me, I know the feeling.
That's, I guess it's a universal thing for people who do what we do. So I'd like to hear more about your background, because I know you, well, you just said something a second ago about like quantum gravity and Is that what did you study? Like what did you focus on when you were an up and coming scientist?
I originally studied mathematics, but then the math department was basically broke. And they couldn't offer me a job. And so they said, well, why don't you walk over to the physics building and ask them, because they normally have use for mathematicians. And that's what I did. And they gave me a job, and they also gave me a desk, and they gave me a topic for my master's thesis. And before I knew, I had a PhD in physics. So I came kind of in through the back door, and it follows me around. You know, I've always felt that I don't really fit into the physics mindset. I came more from this mathematician perspective. I wanted to know what you can do with mathematics. What does it tell us about nature? How much can it tell us? After a long time of erring around through various parts of the foundations of physics, I've now settled on an Institute for Mathematical Philosophy, which, you know, I finally think maybe I'm actually getting where I wanted to be in the first place.
Okay, that's interesting. Can you talk further about that? Like what when you kind of tie mathematics into like the physical universe, like I guess when I start talking about quantum stuff and they say that, you know, everything is probability states and stuff. And it's like, that's just math. Like it just kind of all becomes math at some point. Or if I was British, I would say maths, but that's a whole different thing. I mean,
yes.
Is that kind of where you're coming from in terms of like, how math controls physics and stuff?
Yeah, so I'd say I'm an instrumentalist. I don't actually believe that nature is mathematics, though a lot of theoretical physicists, at least the ones that I know, believe that. I would just say it describes reality, and it does that suspiciously well, you know, as Wigner put it in his essay about the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics and the natural sciences. And that's still somewhat of a mystery. Like, why does it work so well? Mm-hmm. So that certainly intrigues me. But I always have this question, like, why is it this mathematics and why not some other mathematics? Mm-hmm. Like, there's a lot of mathematics that we do not use to describe the universe. Why not? Right? Why this particular piece of it? And what can we learn from the mathematics that we have already found? And also, if you look at the mathematics that we currently use, what's wrong with it? Like in particular, when it comes to quantum mechanics. So that's actually, you know, what my research at the moment is about, is trying to figure out just exactly why do we have problems with quantum mechanics? And, you know, I look at it very much from the mathematical perspective.
I'll jump back to Sabina in just a second, but first let me tell you about today's sponsor, NordVPN. So, look, we're a lot more mobile these days, which is cool, because you can work from anywhere, which I guess also means that you can never get away from work, which kind of sucks, but this is the world today. What can you do? Well, one thing you can do is protect yourself while you're in unfamiliar Wi-Fi networks with a VPN like NordVPN. NordVPN kind of lets you operate on stealth mode around hackers and other dirty Wi-Fi shenanigans, because it basically fools the network into thinking you're somewhere else. NordVPN lets you pick a region of the world, which means you can get access to things that you wouldn't normally be able to access. Like, say you're on Netflix and you can't find your favorite show on it. It might just not be available in your region, but change your region to somewhere else, that show might magically pop up. It's a little sneaky, but you know, hey, it works. But that's just the start. NordVPN also offers threat protection, so if you accidentally click on malware links, which are all over the web, by the way, it'll put a stop to that before it even gets a chance to do anything. And then you've got the dark web monitor. It'll actually let you know if your passwords or credentials get leaked anywhere on the dark web, so you can keep track of that. The point is, you can feel safe and protected when you've got NordVPN. Each account protects up to 6 devices, and they've got 24-hour support. So if you're new to VPNs, maybe feel a little intimidated by it all, they're there to make it comfortable and make it easy for you to do. Just go to nordvpn.com/CWJ, like for Conversations with Joe, CWJ, to get started. And if you sign up for their 2-year plan, you'll get 4 months free. And that's at all levels, even their deluxe complete levels. So it's not just the cheap stuff that you get for free. Everything. free 4 months. Plus, they've got 30-day money-back guarantees, so you've really got nothing to lose. If you've never tried one before, you can give it a try. And if you don't like it, you can cancel. You're out of nothing. So trust me, this isn't something you want to learn about the hard way. Go do it. Protect yourself. That's nordvpn.com/CWJ. It's good for you, helps you feel safe, and it helps support this podcast. Thanks to NordVPN for supporting this episode. And now, back to Sabina.
Yeah, yeah. Well, is that age-old question, and I would love to hear your opinion on this, is math invented or discovered?
Yeah. Well, I would say it's kind of both, right? So we discover some part of it, but we invent the way that we deal with it. So I know that's kind of a lame, it's kind of a lame answer, but I don't feel strongly about it one way or the other. As I said, you know, I'm very much the instrumentalist. I'm like, okay, it's there, it's useful, then let's use it. Like, who cares if it's discovered or invented?
Okay, I got you. I have to imagine that you get a lot of emails and messages on social media from people that want to run their grand theory of everything by you. Yeah. Does that happen a lot?
I wrote a song about this. I don't know if you've seen this. I wrote a song about this, about people sending me their theories of everything.
I just literally 10 minutes ago discovered that you had a channel where you did music. I didn't know this until just a minute ago.
Yeah, I get this a lot. And I'm always sorry. Like, I'm honestly sorry that I don't have time to help those people. I just can't. It's just, you know, I wouldn't do anything else. And I'm saying this because those are people who are like really, really enthusiastic about physics.
Yeah,
they spend a lot of time on it, and they're really trying to understand it. And most of the time, their problem is that there's a big gap between popular science and textbook science, and it's really difficult to bridge this gap. And it adds on top of this that you have a lot of science communicators who try really hard making things sound simple, and they're actually good at it. So people get away with the impression it's actually really simple.
Yeah.
But then, you know, it isn't quite as simple as they make it sound on YouTube.
Mm-hmm. I'm guilty of that. Actually, I always am very careful to be like, I don't understand this. I understand it only at this level. Here are my resources and my sources or whatever. Go look. But I try not to say that things are simple, because it's mostly over my head. I just kind of get it across the best I can. But anyway, but I get what you're saying, though. Like, I get people who send me, I would call it theories of everything, or you know, all kinds of stuff. But and they're very clearly really into it and have spent a lot of time on it, and it's very important to them. But I'm just always like, I'm not the guy to confirm or deny this. I'm just, you know, I'm not the expert in it. So I imagine as somebody who is actually an expert, you might feel a little bit more obligation maybe to do it. Just not having
the
time.
Partly. Though, I mean, I have to say, like, I've never actually worked on theories of everything. Like, I'm not even particularly interested in it. I literally wrote a whole book explaining why I think there isn't such a thing as the theory of everything. So I'm always a little bit surprised. Why do people send me this stuff? And I think the answer is that they have no idea what my research is on in the first place. And they didn't read my books either. They just, I don't know. I think they just send it to me because, you know, my name's out there somehow.
Yeah.
And I've got something to do with physics. So certainly I must know something about theories of everything.
I think people just want validation for their ideas, to feel like they're
I think it's actually more complicated, because a lot of those people, they have no one to talk to. You know, people who can understand the whole theory of everything business, you don't find them everywhere. So you know, most of the time their friends have no idea what they're going on about. Their family is sick of hearing it, and then there are some online forums and, you know, groups and so on, but most of the people you find in those groups have no idea what they're talking about either. So where do you go? You can enroll and in some university thing, but that's going to take like a decade or something until you get somewhere. And so what do? Well, you look up some email addresses online and then you send around your stuff. You know, and I can kind of understand this, but, you know, I'm not the person who's going to solve the problem, basically.
So you mentioned like the, your current research, the stuff you're working on right now, like, is there anything on that that you'd want to talk about? Or is it all kind of public on your blog and stuff?
On my blog, actually, I'm not doing anything on my blog. Okay. I just don't have the time. You know, it's kind of ironic because personally, I prefer writing over doing videos. Mm-hmm. But in reality, I don't have any time left to write.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've written a bunch of papers, which you find on the archive about quantum mechanics stuff. And I have a couple of more coming up, which hopefully I'll get out this year if things go well. Mm-hmm. So we'll see.
Well, I'm curious how you separate your time between like your actual research and the YouTubing stuff. Like how big a part of your workflow is the YouTube and the actual research that you're doing?
It kind of fluctuates wildly. So at the moment, I actually don't get paid for my research, which is why I've been focusing on the science news stuff. Mm-hmm. But I hope that in a couple of months, I'll go back to doing research. And then I've always been the person who has phases where I just have to do research. So there'll be a couple of months where I'm like really working really, really hard, like basically day and night thinking about this one thing because I have to sort it out. Mm-hmm. And then I'd write like three papers in a week. This is how my brain works. Mm-hmm. And then for a couple of months, I'll be so exhausted. The only thing I'll be doing is writing scripts about how terrible quantum mechanics is or something. But, so it's kind of, it's difficult to answer for me the question.
Yeah, I understand the phases thing. I do that myself. I'm like, I'm always falling off of some wagon or developing a habit and then like getting off that habit or something, or falling down a rabbit hole of some specific topic. And then next thing you know, I've got like four videos on the Victorian age or something, you know? Do you feel like just some YouTube shop talk, but are there certain specific topics that you feel like you kind of have to cover? Are there things that you want to step outside of your normal sort of content and just talk about things that are interesting to you, but you feel like you can't, or maybe the videos don't perform as well? I know that's the case for me. There's a lot of topics that I would love to talk about, but I know that like, it's just not my channel, you know?
Yeah, I totally know what you're talking about. So it's one of the reasons why I started doing these weekly science news. Mm-hmm. Is because we have a pretty long lead time for the normal Saturday videos. It's something like 4 to 5 weeks. And if there's some headline coming up, I get a gazillion questions for comments from people on social media. Mm-hmm. And then waiting 5 weeks to comment on the thing doesn't make any sense because by this time people have forgotten what the headline was in the first place. So one of the things that I do with the science news is to comment on some recent headlines. Mm-hmm. Like there was like a couple of days ago, I don't know if you saw this, like there was this big headline that actually black holes are dark energy. So I'll be talking about this on Wednesday. Because I kind of feel like I have to talk about it. Like people expect me to say something about it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, there are a lot of topics that I don't talk about because I'm afraid they're just going glock, glock, glock down to the bottom of the sea. And in my case, it's mostly anything related to medicine. Like I'm super interested in medicine. I read a lot of, especially the research stuff like stem cell therapies and so on, but I'm really afraid to talk about it because I think people they'll not buy it. Like they know I'm not a doctor, I have no background in medicine, and it doesn't really matter how much effort I put into making sure that it's all right. I'm afraid it'll just not fly with my audience, and then not on YouTube in general. Yes, so every once in a while I've tried to talk about something that's a little bit outside my normal stuff, just to test the ground, like how's it go? Sure. Every once in a while, you know, I can't afford putting out a video which doesn't fly. And so this is one of the things that I've been doing. I also talked a couple of weeks ago about social media.
Yeah.
Social media, good or bad. And that actually went quite well, you know, not great, but okay, I'd say. So I'd probably be talking a little bit more about sociology. I also want to talk a little bit more about psychology, so which are all topics that I'm really interested in. I know I say this a lot, like things that I'm interested in. It's a really long list.
Well, I didn't catch that video. What was your determination at the end of it?
Is social media good or bad? Well, yeah. to make a short video even shorter depends on the platform and exactly how you use it. So it's good for some things. It's bad for some things. And it's also quite interesting, which I didn't know before. It depends very strongly on the country. Like, you know, the thing that people talk about a lot with social media use, increasing polarization, like political polarization, seems to be a very American thing. People have actually looked at this in a lot of other countries, and in other countries it went the other way. So polarization actually decreased. So who knew? So
interesting.
Sociology is really difficult. You know, in one country it might go the one way, and other countries might go the other way.
Yeah. I mean, do we have details on why that is? Are people, I mean, the algorithms are the same in the other countries, I would assume, right?
Yeah, so on this particular thing, no. So a lot of this is really still subject of research, as they say.
Sure, yeah.
But I mean, so one interesting thing that I learned from it is actually quite encouraging. It's that just reminding people to think about whether to share an item or not share an item can actually decrease the amount of misinformation that's being spread. And, you know, this makes sense even from my personal experience, that sometimes, you know, I might share stuff because I think it's funny or entertaining and not even think about whether it's even correct. And so just stepping back a little bit and take a few seconds to think about, is this plausible that it might be correct? Mm-hmm. Actually makes the difference.
Yeah. I think, what was her name? Jennifer Haugen, I believe her name was. She was the Facebook whistleblower that happened like a year or so ago. I saw her in an interview, and she was talking about some pretty, what's the right word I'm looking for here? Some ways to slow the spread of misinformation on social media, and some of them that they were playing around with that don't involve, you know, reworking the algorithm and everything. But she was saying one of their ideas that never got implemented, and I think this is a pretty good one, was that an article could only be shared like 2 times before you have to literally cut and paste the URL into a Facebook status. So like if one person shared it and then a friend of yours shared it and then they shared it with you, if you wanted to share it, you would have to literally like open up the page, copy paste, and go through those extra steps to share it. And she was like, that alone helps to cut down on the spread of misinformation, because it's just that one tiny little extra step you got to take. And that might be enough to make you just go, do I really want to share this? You know,
exactly.
And not. I thought that was interesting. Just little things like that that could, you know, that could make things better. Social media is really interesting, and we have a whole generation now growing up with it, and they've been shaped by it in interesting ways. And I'm now of the generation that's like, oh, these young kids, they're so weird, and I don't get their humor and everything. And I'm trying really hard to not turn into those people that like, oh, my generation's the best because we grew up without the internet or something. But I find it interesting that people who are actually being brought up with social media, how that kind of changes their perception of the world and how they interact with people and stuff. It's definitely a sea change, feels like.
Yeah, it's also interesting. So I have two kids. They're now 12 years old. So they're twins. People always get confused about this. So, they learn a lot of the stuff about social media and how to interact with other people and bullying and so on in school. And, you know, they actually do get like social media education and internet education, how to, you know, fact check the stuff that they read, like even at that age. I find it quite remarkable, actually.
Oh, so they actually teach that in school?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't think they do.
I didn't know this either. But yeah, so of course, I don't know how it is but I've read that they also do it in Finland and Sweden and presumably some other countries as well. And so I kind of feel they actually, you know, they do get a pretty good start, actually, probably better than we did, because we had to make all the mistakes ourselves.
Yeah. No, I always wonder that, like, are they more savvy with the social media because they grew up with it and they kind of understand that, you know, some of it's BS and some of it's real? Or is it one of those like fish in the water things? Like they're just so in it that they don't know any different. Me not having any kids and I'm not really around any kids, I just kind of have to sit here and wonder. But it's really encouraging to hear that they are actually having like taking classes in school about, it's almost like media literacy or social media criticism or whatever. I could be wrong, but I don't think that they actually do that here. And it feels like that's a really important thing to teach kids these days.
Yeah, I think there's just generally more awareness of what it can do to you, that it might be bad. And so, like, I mean, there's the question, like, does it actually counterweigh the bad thing sufficiently much, if you see what I mean? Just because people have been warned doesn't mean they'll actually be able to avoid the problem, but at least they're not completely running into it blindly. So our kids actually at the moment do not use social media. They don't yet have their own phones and stuff, but I guess it'll come in the next couple of years, and then we'll see.
Do you have any opinions on where things are going to go next? Because I was just thinking, like, your kids and kids of that generation, something is going to change probably in the next 10 or 15 years. That's going to throw them for a loop, you know, and they're going to be trying to figure out as older people, as they get older. And I don't know. It just got me thinking, like, with all the AI stuff that's going on right now with the ChatGPT and all that. And I haven't heard much talk about the metaverse lately. It seems like it kind of had a moment there, and then everybody was like, oh, this isn't anything. And then it just kind of like went away. VR seems to do that. It kind of like seems to just come up every once in a while. But I wonder if someday, if like, say, they get smart glasses figured out or something, maybe they could actually make something like that work. I don't know. What do you have thoughts on that? Like where things are going to go next?
Well, so I don't know about 15 years, but I mean, at the moment, it's like AI it is the thing, like for images, videos. We're going to see this much more on YouTube. You know, people will just be trying it out. At the moment, it's just too difficult. But when it becomes really mainstream and everyone can use it, we're going to see it all over the place. Mm-hmm. And it's going to make some interesting changes, because I think it'll put a bonus on authenticity, if that's what I can call it. You know, sure. If it becomes so easy to fake something, I think it'll convince people that, you know, a real human being is worth something. Mm-hmm. So this is the one thing that I expect, but in the fairly near future. And there's been a lot of talk about what AI chatbots are going to do to writing. But I actually think what the next big thing that's around the horizon are robots, because that's been kind of building up. You know, robots are now good enough to actually walk around, and with artificial intelligence, they're you know, safe enough, let me put it this way. But at the moment, they're just too expensive. Like, they're just, you know, one of type, basically. But it, so this research is developing so rapidly that I think like in the next 5 years or something, we're going to see like this real boom of consumer-oriented products, all kinds of robots that you'll be able to buy. And you know, at the beginning, they'll still be expensive, but costs will go down rapidly. And then we'll have to see how do we integrate robots in our daily life. Yeah. And then the thing with the metaverse, I think it's one of those ideas that where the time hasn't quite come. But it'll come eventually. I think it's really just a matter of time. Eventually we'll get there, you know, we'll do everything in 3D with some fancy glasses and whatnot.
Yeah, like AR, it's augmented reality and stuff.
Yes, yes, ads everywhere, on all houses, and on the streets, in the clouds, everywhere will be ads.
and they're perfectly like tailored to you, and they're already listening in on our phones, I just know it. Your take on robots is really interesting, though. I hadn't really thought about that. I did a video, I don't know, 6 months ago or something like that. You know, when Tesla started saying they were going to have their Tesla bot or whatever, it got a lot of, you know, laughter and stuff. And they even did an update fairly recently where they were kind of showing off where they've gotten so far. I was actually pretty impressed with it. But my whole thing is always like, the idea of humanoid robots didn't make much sense to me. It felt very human-centric to be like, oh, well, the perfect form must be looking like us, right? But then I did that video, and it was specifically about, like, humanoid robots, what's the point and everything. And I don't know, I kind of came around on that a little bit. It was one of those videos that I guess my opinion changed a bit as I was researching it, because I started to, you know, the point was that, you know, we live in a world that is built for humans, so you want a robot that can function in that world, you know. And I started thinking about, like, you know, I've got two dogs, and every time we travel, we've got to board them, or we've got to find some place to, or somebody to come house sit or something. But I was like, if you had a robot that could just plug itself into the wall when it's not being used, but then, you know, every other hour or so, let the dogs outside, and maybe it can fetch the mail and just kind of like take care of just general stuff around the house to make sure that it's, you know, functioning, like, that would be cool. Like, that's useful, you know. I could totally see that being a thing.
Yeah, I had exactly the same change of mind, you know, thinking like, this is like really human centric. Why don't we build something smarter? Like, if we can do it any way that we want, why make it a human?
The giant octopus, but then I was like,
right. And then I was thinking, what would I want to have a robot for? Well, to, you know, take stuff out of the dishwasher and do the laundry. So the stupid thing would have to actually walk down into the basement. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. How do you do this? Well, you give it legs, right?
Yeah.
Right. So suddenly you have something that looks pretty much like a human.
Mm-hmm. And you always see those videos from Boston Dynamics where Atlas is like doing flips and stuff. I can see it just like doing flips down the stairs. Performing,
yeah.
Only if the camera's on it. I wanted to. There's a couple of questions I wanted to ask while I had you. Being that somebody who is all about getting rid of the gobbledygook, and you know, kind of straightening people up on the science stuff, are there any prevailing science myths that are just like zombie myths? They just keep coming up, no matter how many times you debunk them. You just kind of keep getting fed these questions, or people keep saying, and you're just like, ah, this isn't right. Are there any that stand out to you?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a lot of the stuff that I've already talked about, like, since forever. Partly it's stuff that I actually work on, like, you almost certainly know that we have this big controversy. Is it dark matter, or is it a modification of gravity? And there are just some myths that people bring up over and over again. Like, for example, that modified gravity has been ruled out by the bullet cluster. And I've been on this like a gazillion times, basically, and people still bring it up. I have the impression that now it's gone down a little bit. So maybe I had something to do with it, or maybe people just forgotten about it. But yeah, so the thing is that if you actually look at the literature, no one claims this. Like, this is like a popular science myth that actually through the back door has also infiltrated physics. So this is really bizarre. So I've heard people, you know, referring to this in their talks, like physicists, astrophysicists, and then you go and ask them, like, where's the reference? And they're like, well, but everyone knows this, basically. And I went, where do they know it from?
Yeah, right? Yeah.
And so this is one of those examples. And then there has been this weird confusion. But also this seems to have mostly disappeared about quantum computing, where I actually don't know if you can remember this, but they had this weird distinction between the logical qubits and the physical qubits. And you actually still find this in the literature, but not so surprisingly, a lot of people got really confused about this and didn't know what the difference is. So the logical qubits are basically your perfect things that you can do operations with. And then they'd quote the number of logical qubits that you need to do a calculation that's commercially relevant. And typically that would be something like 150 or something. Then when people started putting out their first quantum computers with like 25, 50, and then 60 and so on, people got really excited because we're getting close to this 150 so quickly. And then I had to explain to them, well, actually, you know, those are physical qubits, and the estimates for the number of physical qubits that you need to get to the commercially relevant applications is more like a million.
Oh, wow.
And when I said this the first couple of times, people wouldn't believe it. You know, I'd actually, this is why I have a standard go-to reference from an NAS report 2018, where they actually have a table where they have those numbers. Okay. So I'm pretty sure it's actually correct. So what's happened in the past couple of years is that people have just stopped talking about those logical qubits. So okay. at least I haven't heard it for a while. So
those are the ones that really matter.
Depends on how you see it. Like like the logical qubits, if you want to know what it takes to actually do a calculation, like in the maths, then the logical qubits are the ones that you need to think about. But in reality, like in the real world out there, it's the physical qubits are the things that you need to build. And those have errors, and you need to take into account those errors. This is why the number of physical qubits is so much larger than the number of logical qubits. So it's one of those things. And then there was a related thing that people got confused about is that you need quantum cryptography to be safe from hacking by quantum computers. Which is not correct, because they're actually classical non-quantum cryptography schemes that, at least for all we currently know, can't be cracked by a quantum computer. It's somewhat confusingly called post-quantum cryptography. And they have partly renamed this now to quantum safe cryptography, which is still quite of a mouthful, but a little bit more descriptive. Yeah. So there have been a couple of those things where I've tried to weed things out, and I think I've kind of been semi-successful. Oh, the thing with the nuclear fusion gain was another one of those. Yeah.
Yeah, lots of headlines around that.
Yeah.
So,
but I think it's actually, you know, it's worked to some extent. At least the people who care about it, like who really interested in nuclear fusion, they know by now that the numbers that you typically see quoted in those press releases don't capture the entire amount of energy that was actually used for the reaction.
Yeah. Well, I mean, how do you feel about that, though? I mean, is it still a big step in your mind?
To get to nuclear fusion to be commercially relevant, it's quite some. I'm actually working on another video about nuclear fusion startups. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of good stuff happening there, but as so often, I think the people are a little bit too over optimistic. You know, I'm pretty sure eventually we'll get there. It's you know, we know that it works. Like in principle, you know, we have all the theories sorted out and it works the way that we expected. It's just an engineering problem.
But a big one.
Yeah.
I always, whenever I look at things like that, I'm always like, there's so much money going into it and there's so much money to be made from it that it's almost like the most pro-capitalism thing I can say. Because there's money to be made, it's going to happen. You're going to see innovation. Like that's the capitalism part of my brain speaking up. But that's always been how I feel about it. Like there's so much money to be made from it that we're going to get there someday because there's just the incentive is just so high.
Well, actually, I think that the money question is actually more difficult than the science question. You know, it's one thing for me to say scientifically they'll get it done eventually, you know, to get more energy out in total than they put in. Whether it'll make commercial sense, that's a much more difficult question.
That's further down the road.
Yeah, and you know that depends on so many other things. Like it depends on what's going to happen with all the costs for the peripherals, like all the equipment that they actually need. Where's that going to go? And what happens with the rest of the world economy? And so on. So God knows. So it might just be maybe I don't know in 20 years or something that they'll figure out how to actually get energy out of the thing, but then they decide it's so ridiculously expensive that it doesn't make any sense.
Especially when you look at how cheap renewables and battery storage has gotten just in the last 20 years. If you project that forward another 20 years, it's probably going to be even less expensive. And I keep hearing that about like normal fission nuclear reactors right now. It's like they're just so expensive to build that economically it just makes more sense to do solar and wind. So that's something I've been hearing anyway.
That's right. I've heard this too. It's only partly correct because it's certainly, you know, some countries have managed to build those things for less cost. Mm-hmm. So it's actually, you know, it's a fairly complicated story. Just why did nuclear fission plants end up being so ridiculously expensive? It didn't have to be that way. And now with there's this big push to these modular reactors. Maybe that'll turn things around, but at the moment it doesn't look like it. Actually they're even more expensive, but who knows? I guess we'll see.
No, but I did a video on the small modular reactors a while back, and I keep there's been one on my list for a while about like fourth generation nuclear. It just kills me that, and I may be wrong about this, but most of the nuclear reactors that are running right now are based off of like 1960s technology. They're just so old, and they've like the technology has come a long way. It just hasn't really become commercially, you know, viable yet. For some reason.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I did a video about nuclear waste. I talk about this a little bit. Like there are so many options what you could be doing with the so-called waste, which for the most part you can still get energy out or you can recycle it or whatever, but we just don't use the technology. You know, we know how it works, we could do it, we're just not doing it.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of hard to live in Germany and be pro nuclear. Oh. But actually, I you know, it's like literally over there, you know, 10 kilometers or something. There's a nuclear power plant, but it's been decommissioned. It's no longer running.
Oh, okay.
That's Germany in a nutshell.
Yeah, Germany kind of went back toward coal, didn't they?
That's right, because Germany does have a lot of coal and it's really cheap and it's just sitting there and you can dig it up and you can burn it, and that's very convenient if it wasn't for this little issue with the carbon dioxide.
Yeah, a little thing. We're getting kind of close to the end here, but I wanted to, I was talking about the robot video earlier and how it kind of changed my mind as I was researching it. Are there any videos that you've done that the kind of were the same thing? Like you had a certain idea going in and then the more you looked at it, it was like, oh, this is actually something different. And it kind of changed the way you saw things.
Yeah, I had one of those recently where I was talking about hydrogen. Like I used to think hydrogen, it sounds really good, right? Is it clean? You can use it to replace fossil fuels. You carry it around, you put it in your tank. Hydrogen cars already exist. And then I looked more at the engineering part of things, and I was like, it's much more complicated than they make it sound. And hydrogen is really nasty stuff. So now I've switched to, now at the moment, I'm a big fan of synthetic fuels.
Okay.
Because I feel like the infrastructure is already there. So that's like the obvious thing to do. You have to take renewable energies, you make your synthetic fuel, you put it into your car the same way that you previously did. But I haven't really looked into it. So God knows what I'll find.
that'll change you again. It's like, oh God, it's hydrogen all over again. So the synthetic fuels would be like stuff that's where they've maybe pulled it from the carbon in the air or something. And it's almost carbon neutral instead of carbon.
Yeah, exactly. That's the idea, right? You take it out of the air, invest energy to make your fossil fuel. It could be any kind. And then you burn it and you release the carbon dioxide again.
Are you going down? I always like to ask this of people. Are you going down any rabbit holes right now? Are there any subjects that you've suddenly gotten into, or videos on YouTube, or books that you've read that just has sparked a curiosity about something that maybe you don't normally get to talk about? What are you into that you don't normally get to talk about?
That I normally don't get to talk about. I've recently been thinking a lot about the sociology part of social media, which and it started with this first video that I've been doing. And so now I have another video coming up about collective stupidity, like the opposite of collective intelligence. So I've done a lot of reading about why sometimes groups of people are intelligent, come to good decisions, and sometimes they don't.
Interesting.
So I found some interesting stuff, but you'll have to wait for the video to figure out what.
No sneak peek.
And this is kind of, you know, once you look into this, there's more. So I'm still reading papers about the sociology of groups and also the psychology. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff about those weird relationships that we're having with our audience. It's called a parasocial relationship, that kind of screws with our, you know, inborn way of having relationships. It's kind of unnatural if you think about it. And there are lots of things that are going wrong in this. And so I found this very interesting, you know, just also on a personal level, you know, trying to understand what's actually going on.
Yeah, yeah. I'm reading a book right now. It's called The Attention Merchants. And the reason I was reading it is because I've developed this theory about the world that, you know, we're living in an attention economy. I didn't make this up, other people have, but that, you know, attention is the current major currency of the world, you know, and that explains a lot of really bad behavior that you see, especially on the part of public figures and stuff. And I feel like that explains cancel culture a little bit, that, you know, it's not really so much about everybody really being righteously indignant about something. It's just piling on in a mob mentality kind of thing, you know, and scoring fake internet points and whatnot. It's become a subject I've become really interested in. So this book so far has been, I'm only about maybe a third of the way through it right now, but it's about the whole history of advertising and propaganda and how it was first kind of used in World War I and stuff like that. And actually a little bit before that, but which is also kind of interesting because I worked in advertising for 15 years. I was a copywriter for a long time. So the history of advertising and like the theories behind like social, what do they call it? Social engineering. That's what it was. I think it was like consumer demand engineering or something like that was the term that they used. Anyway, it's all very interesting to me. And especially when they get into the propaganda of like, you know, the Nazis and stuff like that and how they, you know, kind of used what had been learned in the advertising world and stuff. And anyway, it's a very interesting subject is what I'm saying. So I'm glad to hear you're on the case.
Yeah, I've been thinking from this perspective of social media about this advertisement part, because you know, if you put enough money into advertisement, you can kind of make everything look interesting. Mm-hmm. And there is certainly some players, let me put it this way, who've done that, you know, with climate change denial. Yeah. and that kind of stuff. And so it becomes a really dangerous subject.
Yeah. Well, it's something that's been on my mind a lot lately is, and I'm sure you can, you know, identify with this, is that, you know, YouTube being what it is, and you have to kind of like be as bombastic as possible in your headlines and your thumbnails and stuff to get people's attention to click on it. I'll put it this way. I have a guy who edits my videos. His name is Nick. And from time to time, I'll make a joke about something being clickbait or whatever the subject is that I'm talking about. I'll joke about it being clickbait. And he'll make an over-the-top, ridiculous clickbait thumbnail as a joke, with all the circles and the arrows and all the thumbnail tropes and stuff like that. And on at least three occasions that I can think of, he made that joke thumbnail and I was like, screw it, I'll use it. So I actually used it as the thumbnail to my video, and those have always performed better using a joke thumbnail. And so I get irritated because I feel like you're incentivized. Actually, it's beyond incentives. It's almost like you absolutely have to stretch the truth almost to the point of misinformation in your titles and thumbnails for it to perform the way you want it to perform in YouTube. And I'm constantly having this debate in my head over how far can you push it before you're just adding to the misinformation in the world. Even if in the video you're you know, debunking whatever it is that you're talking about or whatever, and you're getting the right information out, most people don't actually click on the video. They just see the title and the thumbnail, and then that little piece of information is now embedded in their heads, and they're going to carry that with them, you know. That's a big debate that I have going on, and I don't like that I have to have this debate. I wish it didn't work that way. It just does, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of like the thing with athletes, right? They're like incentivized to push it exactly to the border where mm-hmm. where it, you know, it becomes kind of illegal or really, really bad. And then you're hanging there just before the cliff, basically.
Yeah.
But, you know, YouTube, I find YouTube like really unpredictable almost. It's like some of my best ranking videos were on topics that I personally think are terribly boring.
Yeah.
Like, for example, my most watched video is about the question, does the past still exist? Like, this is about as far away from clickbait as you can possibly be. But there are like 3 million people have watched it. Uh-huh. And this is special relativity, standard textbook stuff. There isn't even anything new in it. Uh-huh. So, and I'm still surprised about this. I'm like, I've no idea what's so great with the video. I mean, it's not like I'm complaining, but you never know.
My most viewed videos are all on like really dark topics. The biggest one for a long time was how long a severed head survives after it's been chopped off.
Yeah,
seriously.
I saw the thumbnail, but I didn't watch the video. I think I don't want to know how they found out.
Well, that one recently got surpassed by a video on the worst human experiments of all time.
Mm, nice.
Yeah, which was pretty dark too. So maybe I should just go real dark. Just go for it. I don't think anybody really wants that. Well, I didn't want to keep you too long, but, I wanted to give you a chance to talk about your book, or like a chance to talk about places that I could point people to look into your work and everything. Obviously there's your YouTube channel and whatnot. Like what else could you?
Yeah, I've just published, it's not quite as recent anymore, but in August last year, I published my second book. It's called Existential Physics, a Scientist's Guide to the Biggest Questions in Life, or something mm-hmm. like this. And this question, like, does the past still exist, is one of them. But there's it's 9 chapters, and each of them is a big question, like, has physics ruled out free will, for example? Is human behavior predictable? And then I go down, what do we know, what do we not know, and yeah. what's the conclusion? So it's a fun book, I think.
Well, I'm known as the existential angst guy, or some people call me that, so it sounds right up my alley. It's like a book that will make you question all of existence. Maybe not quite, but
yeah. Well, I've actually tried to make it, you know, optimistic, uplifting. After I thought that my first book was kind of depressing.
Oh. Well, cool. I haven't had a chance to look at it yet, but it definitely sounds up my alley. I should probably get my hands on one. I think we can wrap it up. I'm just really glad I got a chance to talk with you and meet you finally.
Good to talk to you.
Big thanks to Sabina for coming on. It was a pleasure getting to meet her, and you can find her YouTube channel on YouTube. Her new book, Existential Physics, A Scientist's Guide to Life's Biggest Questions, can be found on Amazon or pretty much everywhere you buy books. I'll put links to her website and social media in the description. One last little bit of house cleaning business. If you don't know, I do have a new website. It's kind of my new hub for all my stuff, my main channel, TMI, this podcast. You can find all my old interviews there, and as I branch off into more non-YouTube-related stuff, you'll be able to find that stuff there too. Anyway, it's thatjoescott.com. So like if somebody were to say, which Joe Scott? And you say, that Joe Scott. You can also find all the merch around my channels there. Cool t-shirts, mugs, posters. Some of it channel branded. Some of it just fun that you can wear around. It helps support the channel and it gives you something cool to wear. So there you go. This episode was produced by Kimmy Britt, edited by Bray Brown. I'm Joe Scott. You can find me at Answers with Joe pretty much everywhere on the socials. Of course, my YouTube channel is Answers with Joe. Anyway, thanks a lot for listening. Please do share this if you thought it was interesting, and a nice review on whatever podcast player you're using right now really does go a long way. But until next time, thanks. Have a good one. Now go out there and start some conversations of your own. Take care.